Welcome to Discursion Film Podcast. We've decided this is episode 6 after researching how many episodes we've done. Bit of confusion behind the scenes. Today we're talking about the Marx Brothers Duck Soup, classic talky American comedy. My name is Stephen.
I'm Dominic.
And I also should introduce our special guest, Polly Rose, who is a doctoral researcher and film editor. I believe you... you speak at Slapstick Festival this year, did you do that?
I introduced Battling Butler, yes. Keaton film at Slapstick this year. Yeah.
Oh. I was going to say, what Polly doesn't know about Buster Keaton probably isn't worth knowing. So.
I do have a Buster Keaton Marx Brothers fact, which I will give you later.
Oh!
More than one.
That and more.
can't wait.
In today's podcast episode.
Is this our first comedy?
Yeah, it might well be, unless you want to count the bit of Japanese. We, you know, sort of flirted with the Japanese comedy, didn't we? But,
that's true. House is a comedy horror.
Yeah. But this is more...
Is this a comedy horror?
Is this a comedy horror? Maybe it's a comedy disaster film.
I think that the... I don't have to avoid spoilers, do I?
No. That's fine. Spoilers. Also, one of our principles is like, excellent. Yes, not to avoid spoilers. So, fabulous. Not that the plot of Duck Soup is perhaps it.
No, but yes, the ending. The ending of the film could definitely be described as a disaster movie, I think, or probably many disaster movies brought together in one disaster movie.
Had you seen it before, Polly?
I had seen it. I haven't seen this this new version, this new restoration. But I had, I'd seen the film itself before. It was very nice to see it again. I do enjoy the mayhem of Duck Soup.
Yeah. We're watching the Blu-ray release from Arrow Films.
Which I'm showing the microphones. Works excellent.
But this is a Paramount release at the time, and I think it was quite a good relationship between the Marx Brothers and the Paramount Pictures studio. They had 5 films with them. Previously, they were on stage as a sort of comedy family act. Mm. By the heart, Marx Brothers, we are talking about Harpo, Groucho, Zeppo, and
Chico. In an unusual order, there.
It was.
Zeppo will be glad with his billing in that list, I think.
Did I say Zeppo first?
Zeppo came at least third, I think.
Because I always worry about forgetting him. I think that's why I mentioned him first.
Poor old Zeppo.
I read that after this film, Zeppo went off and started a talent agency with Gummo. Because I think the MGM films were just the trio of Groucho, Harpo, and Chico. So this was our last chance to see Zeppo and his artfully ripped shirt, I noticed, in the war scenes.
Yeah.
Oh,
this
that.
Seems to be what Zeppo, one of the things that Zeppo brings to the Marx Brothers.
I felt it took longer to get going than I was expecting it to. It doesn't sort of plunge you into mayhem or have sort of some, you know, golden gags right at the beginning to make sure you're... I don't know, it felt to me like it took slightly longer than I was expecting, than I remembered, but that might be just me.
I think it did, also the pace was slower, wasn't it? And I think Groucho felt rather, his set pieces do feel a little like set pieces at the beginning. I think Chico and Harpo, when they're doing their physical comedy around the peanut stands, that feels, that has more life and more kind of improvisatory feel to it, more energy, whereas some of Groucho's stuff at the beginning does feel, I think that added to your sense of it taking a while to get going. There was a bit of a stilted declamatory part to which he definitely warmed up as the mayhem increased around him.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. It feels like...
But there are details and slight adjustments that are made, I think, during those set pieces. The camera might pan to the clock and back again, or one of the Marx Brothers might enter the frame and just slightly kind of shift their position. There is a bit of a leeway. It doesn't completely come to a standstill and present you with a tableau, I think. There are quite precise movements that are being made during that opening sequence, I think. Those are quite different. Those jokes that are in sort of in frame in those long shots where it's all about the composition coming together versus the very intimate physical comedy that you have, yeah, around the peanut stand between Chico and Harpo and the vendor.
Yeah.
Actually, yes, it's interesting in terms of that. You do have some of those shots and some of the big sets that I think we'd noticed, where there's a real grandeur to some of those big wide shots and casts of thousands and that operatic kind of operetta feel, which is very much part of the film. But then you do have the more classic, you know, Chaplin-esque framing of the two people full frame chucking stuff at each other, which is also very satisfying. But
I wonder who is this for. I mean, this, yeah, as it says, yeah, we're informed on the back of the DVD case that it's, you know plots are unimportant, it's the gag set pieces and one-liners that matter, but the plot could be much thinner and the gags could have been, you know, strung on it equally effectively. It feels like it's got quite a lot of plot.
Yeah. No, and that does drive it along, and it does feel, it almost feels like a combination of a fairly straight operetta about these two small kingdoms, with then the zaniness, which is overlaid, which for me, I enjoy that. It works quite well, I think. I was surprised again, about the amount of plot that we were being given.
Yeah, I've forgotten how much of an operetta it really is, sort of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah.
I mean, the songs, yeah.
And I think, I assume that Margaret Dumont's doing her own vocals, but I mean, it certainly plays to... I did enjoy Margaret Dumont as the straight woman with Groucho, and that interplay between them, I think, is really... She does straight woman very well,
I was thinking,
and her charming smile.
Yeah, I was thinking about that explicitly, actually, about, yeah, her role, about that, yeah, the straight person role, and if it's... I probably can't think of any specific examples, but I feel there are other cases, probably from this time, where you would have the straight person, but who gets allowed to have a couple of laughs. I mean, laughs, not at the character's expense.
Yes.
Whereas she really doesn't.
She's so in character, isn't she?
Yeah.
She so does that role, but you kind of get a sense of the performer enjoying that as well. It's which I think is part of the pleasure.
Could you say it's a little bit like she's, you know, she thinks she's in a different film. I mean, you know, her character.
Yes, her character. No, absolutely. And I think that prequel, not the prologue, where we are set up, that we are in Fredonia and that they are in financial crisis and that she bizarrely has bailed them out once already in the power of her widow's fortune. That little, it almost is another film, isn't it? And then slightly tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
And then as soon as that wonderful picture of Groucho gazing winsomely up in his statesmanlike pose in the newspaper lets us know what's coming, if we didn't know from the ducks in the pot at the beginning of the...
Yes. But it's interesting what needs to be explained and what doesn't. I mean, if, you know, because it goes further into constructing a plot that makes a kind of sense, then it sort of strictly seems to need to. But then there's no explanation whatsoever of why Groucho's character is, for a moment, considered as appropriate candidate. that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, like, yeah, I said, in the context, I mean, I'm just asking the wrong question, but, it, you know, because like you say, it has given us a setup that has a reasonable amount of plot.
Yes.
Yeah. We should probably briefly recap that. Because, like you say, there is a surprising amount of plot, but you are drawn immediately to the gags, which kind of fragment the film to some extent. But it's a time of economic crisis and a time of strange political change, because Groucho Marx, of all people, is elected as, I don't know, I can't remember his official title, if he's president of Fredonia. Yeah.
Well, he's not even elected, is he?
They call him Your Excellency.
Yeah.
And it's this small sort of Bavarian-looking castle-y town. And then he ends up declaring war on a neighbouring nation or state because the leader of that state is also the suitor, right?
He's aiming to take over the state, isn't he, by marrying the Margaret Dumont character.
Yeah.
So
it does sort of fall apart if you ask too many questions, because he declares war because he's insulted, but in fact becomes sort of, you know, the insult seems to have been all kind of amicably forgotten, and then when when he remembers what particular insult that particularly upset him, which was Upstart, then it comes. But it's true that, that there is political intrigue and they are trying to take over the each other's countries, but those two strands don't particularly...
We have Chico and Harpo as spies of the love rival, who is only a love rival in order to take over the country, don't we? Which is that whole spying subplot is going on. I think they largely go to war because Groucho's put down a month's deposit on the battleground.
Oh yes,
we're never going to get
That's
out
right.
of it after that.
That's so. Right.
I was interested with the war scenes though, because I know there was criticism. Just to mention Buster Keaton very briefly, the General in 1926, which was about 7 years before this, one of the reasons why this is why it was considered to have been less successful in the 20s than it is now considered was the bleakness of the comedy around war. Yeah. And actually, I was intrigued how much, you know, there was quite a lot of bleakness in this yes. these war scenes. There were Groucho yeah. shooting his own men and then paying off his secretary not to talk about it. And there yeah. it wasn't. But it was quite dark, but very silly.
Yes.
And all the many costumes from the many eras of war. I mean, it's
yeah.
very
yeah.
pleasingly ridiculous. But it was quite dark. And, and interesting, how did that come across at a time in 1933 when Hitler was really starting to get himself together? You've got all that satirizing of leaders and of big costumed marching, and you know,
yeah.
I wondered how much
yeah.
that was playing into it
yeah.
as well at that time.
But that's right. But all that war stuff is happening also at the point. So obviously, the film is sort of is building up to its conclusion or its climax. But that's also at the point when it's the sort of highest density of gags.
Yes.
And I suppose maybe that's what I mean. Maybe I just have a short attention span. But I could have kind of done with, in some place. I could have done with a faster rhythm of gags. You know, through the film as a whole, I found that there were bits where the narrative, it's not like The Great Dictator or something, where the narrative is like, this is fine, but I'm not, I don't know.
There were scenes that you felt were just narrative scenes rather than
just a little bit
woven in gags.
Just
yeah.
slightly slower than I would have. I mean, I don't want to be cast in the role of having a go at the Marx Brothers or at Liam McCary or whoever.
Sure.
But I had that experience that I felt there are more and less rewarding kind of sequences. And for me, the sections of the film that are most rewarding are where they do kind of cram a hell of a lot in, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, think something a bit later. I mean, something like Hell's a Poppin' as well. It's a bit later, isn't it? I watched that not that long ago. My memory of that, again, is this sense of gags in every corner.
Absolutely. And it was felt that it was not possible to even film that, wasn't it?
Right.
Before they made it.
Right.
Because the stage show was so crazy for Hell's a Poppin', and they clearly did a very
yeah.
good job.
Yeah.
But it had been considered unfilmable
then,
for that dense and chaotic reason.
Right. But then my memory of this film was my memory of it was more densely gag-filled than the actual experience of having just watched it now, which is...
Yeah, I found that on subsequent viewings as well. I first saw this film in LA with an American audience who were really into it and were whooping and cheering throughout and got all of the lines. And then watching it on my own...
Are there particular bits that they really thought were hilarious that you didn't even...
It was difficult to discern.
Right.
but that, when you watch it with an audience like that, the laughter does pave over those more stilted moments, I think.
That's a really interesting point.
And
they did. They did. Yeah.
You need to breathe.
And you need to allow space if you are watching it with an audience.
Mm.
You can't put the gags too closely without the laughter going over the top of the line, which means that you miss the next gag. So that's that spacing. That's an interesting point, that things that we now find a bit
right.
slow
yes.
watching it in a video, home video context, may have been paced for a big cinema full of laughing people. It's interesting as well with Leo McCary that he was someone who had come obviously from silent comedy, went on to make The Awful Truth in 1937, which was famously the point at which Cary Grant discovered the more improvisatory way of working in cinema and had initially asked to be taken off the film because he didn't like it, and then discovered that this was actually something he was very keen on. But the combination of that kind of improvisatory working, I felt actually this seemed more scripted in some ways than I was expecting from that combination of the Marx Brothers, who were famously ad-libbing and chaotic. And Leo McCarey, who even in scripted classical Hollywood screwball comedy would improvise on set. It's actually rather more templated.
Is it the most famous set piece from this film, the mirror gag?
Almost definitely.
Yes. You know, that and also the whole gag with the hats and things, yes, with the peanut stand. That's extremely
wonderful,
rehearsed.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how much of that came from their vaudeville act, because I mean, obviously the mirror is a piece which, you know, Chaplin did in The Floorwalker in 1916. I think Harold Lloyd did in Marathon 1919. And I saw online on silentcomedymafia.com forum, they were saying that there's an Alice Guy Blaché directed film from 1912 which has that routine, and clearly before that it came from the stage. So I'm and then Harpo went on and did it with Lucille Ball in I Love Lucy in the 50s. So you've got that. How often had they done that routine before this film? And is that rehearsal something which had actually been happening for years on stage? Or was it, obviously, again, I'm sure they topped it up. But I'd love to know the history of that mirror routine within the Marx Brothers stage act, actually, where that came from.
And the hat thing, well, it's the vaudeville thing, like you say, but the hat thing is also like, it's also Waiting for Godot. They have the hat, like, gag thing, I think, in that, which is kind of, I don't know, just all those... Well, there's various things coming off those early traditions and going in really quite different places, but still keeping those sort of links there.
The film proves that hats are funny. Different kinds of hats.
Hats are so funny.
Different kind. They're very expressive and characterful, aren't they?
Yes. I think my favourite is Groucho's enormous sort of bear skin, whatever you'd call that, sort of kind of Russian soldier's helmet thing that's about 4 foot tall.
They do have some amazing war hats, and I think also the running gag that goes through this film of Harpo and his scissors just snipping everything off, and there's so much play when Zeppo comes in with half a hat, with Harpo having just left, but then he takes the tail off the another one of Groucho's hats, furry hats, and then decapitating the what do you call them, those rather martial German helmets that the soldiers of Fredonia have
in with the sort of brush on the top.
With a brush on the top, and then Harpo chopping all those brushes off the top as well. So there's an awful lot of comedy decapitation hat potential in this film.
You get the little moments just thinking about that just after he's done that. There's a bit, so when then there's the gag of them playing, as it were, in a glockenspiel on the helmets of all the various soldiers. And then when they're then the soldiers are marching off, and then Harpo hits the last one on the head, and it really looks like the guy, I don't know, just from the reaction of the actor who's hit on the head, I kind of at the moment of like, that looked like he probably did clonk him quite hard on the head.
I was quite surprised by the violence of Harpo's character the first time I watched this film.
Yeah.
He's my favourite Marx brother, and he has a delicacy to him because he was a musician, and he obviously was very well trained. And I think you can see in the banjo sequence, he might be the only one who's actually playing some chords there. But he's also got a violence to him as well. And that obviously has been rehearsed, but for me, there's quite clearly a danger to those performances. You know, no matter how well they've been rehearsed, getting your scissors out, chopping people's hair off, you know, it puts there's an extra level of enjoyment there beyond laughing. There's a risk.
I think that particularly in the scene we were talking about with the peanut stands, Harpo's character in that, there's a real menace, isn't there? Which I think more so than in, I haven't seen anywhere near all Marx Brothers films, but he doesn't have this seems to be the most menacing that I've seen him. That kind of the combination of the big smile and the real steel behind it, particularly in that scene, and that poor man with his hats being continually put on the roasting flame on the peanut stand.
I can't help but think of Chaplin's lynching street scene, where there's the hanging on the lamppost.
I haven't seen that.
I did feel a little bit sorry for the street
vendor.
He's bullied.
Yeah.
particularly to the point where Harpo actually comes out with a bath and chases him.
Yeah, that moment is great. You're sort of, because you're just waiting for him to appear from somewhere, but yeah, from it's sort of a stupid thing to say, but about, you know, the extent to which it's dated, because of course, you know, nobody makes films like this now. But
I mean, the dated part for me is the misogyny, really. That's the most obvious. Those parts are not just old hat, they're a bit distasteful, I think. There's a nastiness to those parts as well.
Yeah, and that is part of Harpo's character, I think. I mean, obviously Groucho is the one who has the most obvious on-screen engagement with women and with Margaret Dumont's character, but I think the whole business of Harpo just following the women.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And, whenever anyone appears, and that whole, you know, the send help. If you can't send help, send two women. And Harpo holds up two fingers. Send three women. Mm. It is, in some ways, I find Groucho's relationship with Margaret Dumont, and possibly it's because I do get a sense that it's kind of a fun interaction between those two performers, I find that less uncomfortable than I do more of the Harpo stuff, the slight, and obviously. The very glamorous lady in her mirror dress.
Is it because Harpo doesn't necessarily interact, he just does?
Yes, I think that's the... For me, I mean, you know, I'm sure you can take down pretty much all the portrayals of and interactions with women in this film. But I think in terms of the level of uncomfortableness for me as a viewer, definitely yes. Harpo's slight distance from and pursual of and, yeah, lack of an ongoing interactive.
I mean, actually, the
scene with the woman and the horse with Harpo, I find less because it's so silly. He's in bed. The horse is there. She'll be fine. You know, she's... But the previous woman, the lady who seems to be married to the lemonade stand vendor, who is the big angry man throughout the film, that is somewhat.
Yeah.
Scary, and him trying to pull her into the cupboard with him, and all of that kind of stuff, and the secretary in the office of the ambassador, who was the love rival for Margaret Dumont, when Harpo just basically follows her cleavage as she walks out of the room.
Yeah.
I feel like possibly I'm letting Groucho off rather too lightly in this way, but I enjoy Margaret Dumont so much that she seems okay. She kind of seems in control. You know, she's so for me, I find that a pleasurable interaction to watch. Whereas, some of those other things in the film, are not.
I was thinking just in the edits, there are certain edits that aren't particularly smooth. But, you know, they're doing some big kind of routine and people have police shifted around. But it doesn't, I don't know, this is me. I'm like, it doesn't quite feel like that's a result of, you know, trying to capture something which was sort of live and, you know, spontaneous, and so it would be different takes. It does feel very constructed for the edit, you know.
Absolutely. I think it does feel not necessarily storyboarded in the sense of actually storyboarded, but it feels like they've got the wide, they've got the close, and they're picking it up from that point. It's interesting, in this era you do have more of those mismatch things where people have slightly moved off their spot or whatever, and I don't know whether some of it is quite simply, it's just like, we're getting this film out to a schedule, and you know, we're, as long as it's kind of okay. I think, I wonder whether there was more audience tolerance for that kind of slight continuity mismatch in placing and in movement and stuff, that because you do see a lot of that in these early 30s talkies, I think, as well, because I wonder whether it, to a degree, it's to do with the new technology of working with sound, and that you're limited by the sound that you're working with, and sometimes that's dictating a cut point in a way that in a silent film, you might have been able to make it slightly nicer.
Yeah.
It's interesting on this restoration, actually, that the sound is all very smooth and sounds very lovely, and previously when I'd seen it, there's one of the scenes at the peanut stand, where Chico has got his dog, and there's clearly a line which has been overdubbed. He turns away and says something about the dog while looking at the dog, and that the sound quality of that line is very different.
Right.
There is more of a sense that it's a slight rag bag, and that they are, you know, it's not as smooth. And I think this lovely restoration has smoothed the sound out, so it's a much smoother watch. But the possibly older versions of it reveal some of the difficulties of the sound. I mean, that's new technology.
There's quite a lot of post-sync in the film, though, more than I was expecting.
Yes. And some of the lip sync is quite off, isn't it, as well? Particularly in some of those early scenes, it's it comes and goes.
Yeah,
which really points up that.
But then that would slightly either go against your or they're making a best of a bad job and they were trying to do sync sound and they could, and it went so, or if they were not assuming that they were or if they were always planning to dub those scenes, then they wouldn't have had.
Yes.
The restrictions, because
there's a flexibility there as well, a disjuncture between sound and image. I'm just thinking about when Harpo trashes the speaker, and it won't die. It just keeps playing,
which
is a very old joke. I don't know how old it was at this point.
But I'd forgotten the film. I was almost expecting the gag to be that it wasn't the
I was expecting
an orchestra to be outside.
A band outside. I thought he was going to chuck that radio and it was going to hit the orchestra that was outside. And I was quite disappointed when that didn't happen, because the sound mix had led me to expect
me
that. Absolutely.
We haven't really talked about Chico at all.
No.
Chico's really interesting. Something that occurred to me watching it this time is Chico is almost the straight man sometimes, but he also has his scenes where he's not. Obviously, he gets to do his bit, but quite often he functions as the straight man in the routines, which because obviously he's from the Italian comic, and so there was early in the century. Many vaudeville acts were based on, so Keaton's family act were based on the fact that they were Irish, caricature Irish people. You had Dutch comedians who were caricatured German. And so Chico being an Italian comedian was a thing in a way that it's not now. And so it's almost like his thing is less there than the thing that distinguishes him. I mean, obviously, Zeppo is the one where we're still wondering what distinguishes Zeppo exactly.
Yes.
But it's interesting. In terms of what you were saying about what dates, I wonder whether Chico's persona is something that reads quite differently now in a way that Harpo's and Groucho's have stayed more consistent through the years.
But maybe that sort of New York sort of Italian thing, which Groucho that has actually, it's morphed into other things, but maybe that has actually stayed or has more of a heritage that we can still recognise, whereas Chico, which is an aspect of the same thing, but it hasn't
definitely. And I mean, his hat was worn by other Italian in inverted commas comics, that kind of the Groucho's New Yorker image has remained fairly constant, hasn't it? You, as you say, you still recognise that in a way.
You know, Chico's gags about the linguistic gags in the courtroom scene where it seems like the character is deliberately misunderstanding. That seems to be how it works, right? Because he has some line about, oh, I'm doing well, aren't I? So it's not that he's not meant to actually not understand what people say. But that wouldn't work without his accent, and
Yes, his accent's part of that, isn't it? But as you say, it's not that he's a stupid Italian man. The gag is that he does wordplay and he does deliberate misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And then I love, I don't know how it fits into the persona in that way, but When Were You Born? I don't remember. I was a little baby. It's just wonderful. It's my favourite Chico line in this film, I think. That lovely logic that they have, which is...
Maybe that's what he brings, a logic in his wordplay that you don't have so much with Groucho. I don't know. There's wordplay with both of them, but it seems to be more direct with Chico's character.
I have to tell you my Buster Keaton, Marx Brothers quote.
Yes.
Should you care to hear it?
Because
when they were at MGM later in the 30s, Keaton was one of their gag men briefly when he was down on his luck and working for $100 a week. And he said, when you hired the Marx Brothers, the first thing that you did was to hire 3 assistant directors, one for each Marx Brother. And to get them all on the set at the same time was an event. That part of the challenge of working with the Marx Brothers, at least at that point in time, was just getting them all on the stage. But the interesting thing is he remarked about how much they weren't bothered about what was coming up in the next scene. They just would ad-lib it. In terms of what we're discussing, in terms of what was structured, what was pre-planned and what was ad-libbed, certainly as he chose to tell the experience of working with them, they were not concerned about the structure or the narrative of their films. They were going to turn up and do their thing, and they were quite happy to ad-lib. And that craziness is not feigned.
But does that mean that the whole gag about Groucho's arrival, you know, he's always on time and he's massively late, is that about
them? One suspects that was an in-joke for anyone who had worked with the Marx Brothers. Yes, I think it may well be.
I like that.
Well, Polly, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. That's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, you're a font of knowledge.
Random facts.
I guess we'll be back soon with another film.
As usual, we don't yet know what it is.
But it's going to be something that's been recently released or reissued on DVD and Blu-ray. Please like and subscribe. We're on iTunes, Podbean, and Spotify. And follow us at Discursion Film on Twitter. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.